WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The shooter who tried to assassinate former President Trump and killed one person at the rally and critically injured two others used an AR-15. Today we talk about why this rifle has become the weapon of choice for mass shooters, an icon in gun culture, and how it was created for military combat use and then adapted into a rifle for civilians, with the help of clever marketing and lobbying. We'll talk with Todd Frankel, the lead reporter on the main story of a Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post investigation into the history of the AR-15. Later, Ken Tucker continues his series revisiting great albums recorded 50 years ago with a Stevie Wonder album. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've postponed our interview with former Hollywood stuntman and director of the new film The Fall Guy so that we can address what's on everybody's mind right now, the attempted assassination of former President Trump and the other victims of the shooter. Two were seriously injured, one was killed. The shooter used an AR-15, an assault weapon that has become the preferred weapon of mass shooters. My guest Todd Frankel wrote about how the civilian rifle was adapted from the military combat automatic rifle, the M16, and how, with the help of clever marketing and lobbying, the AR-15 has become a huge moneymaker for the gun industry, an icon of gun culture, a favored weapon for perpetrators of mass shootings, and a flashpoint in the debate about guns in America. Frankel was the lead reporter on the main story of a Washington Post investigation into the history of the AR-15. The series won a Pulitzer Prize this year for national reporting. Frankel is an enterprise reporter on the financial desk of the Post. We're going to hear the interview we recorded this morning. Then we'll dive deeper into the gun's history and current place in gun culture and listen back to the interview we recorded last year when the AR-15 series was published. Todd Frankel, welcome back to Fresh Air. What was your reaction when we heard the shooter used an AR-15?
Not surprised. I think every time there's a shooting, especially one that's so high profile or a mass shooting, the first question that I have, and actually a lot of gun makers always have, is, was it an AR-15? And this time it was.
Why is that the first question?
It's because it's become such a popular weapon for use, popular period, and then also popular for use in these sort of horrific mass events. It's everywhere. And, you know, 1 in 20 gun owners in America has an AR-15, it's estimated. The thing's just blown up and taken over the gun market. And so not only is it popular amongst all gun owners, it's popular amongst this subset of folks who, when they want to cause death and destruction, this is what they reach for.
The AR-15 is banned in several states, including Washington, California, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Maryland, Illinois, Delaware, and some chains like Walmart and Dick's Sporting Goods no longer sell it. What impact has that had on that rifle?
In some ways, it's sort of raised the profile of the rifle because it's made it sort of a taboo weapon that some places don't want you to have. And it hasn't had any effect on sales, really, because some folks in some states perhaps can't get one. And also, all these bans are sort of on shaky legal ground, with the Supreme Court showing its willingness to overturn any gun ban, with the Bruin decision a couple years ago affecting handguns and the right to own that. A lot of folks expect that any gun law that has been passed nationwide is perhaps going to get new scrutiny.
And in jeopardy?
Yes, definitely in jeopardy.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the site of the Republican convention. Wisconsin is an open carry state. Does that include assault weapons?
It does. And it makes it sort of a challenge for law enforcement, these open carry laws. Famously, I think a couple years ago, there was that young kid, Kyle Rittenhouse, who was open carrying an AR-15 during one of the Black Lives Matter protests in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And, he ended up killing, I think, two people and wounding another. And the simple act of wearing this weapon, which part of its appeal is that it looks menacing and it has a real high profile and people sort of recognize it immediately, you can just wear it going down the street as long as you're not sort of brandishing it, not sort of pointing it at people and stuff, as long as it's just slung over your shoulder or across your chest. And it's, to some folks, it's a really difficult thing to digest, to see, but, that's where our laws stand in several states right now.
The AR-15 has become kind of a symbol for people on the right. How is it used as a symbol?
It's become stand-in for the musket, the Revolutionary War musket. It's a symbol of freedom. It's a symbol of gun rights. Without a doubt, there were folks at that Trump rally in Pennsylvania who had, the image of the AR-15 on a T-shirt or on their hat. I mean, it's everywhere. And it's become much larger than just a gun. It's become this symbol of freedom. Part of it, the appeal and the marketing is also that it antagonizes the so-called left, the folks who aren't quite so comfortable with this weapon. It's almost like this litmus test of how you react to the very distinct outline of this gun, you know, with its, it's a long gun, it's a rifle, and it has, you know, the clip that, the magazine clip that extends down below. It's instantly recognizable, and it has this military bearing. It looks, you know, it looks like an M16. And, you know, that the fact that it sort of provokes strong reactions, both of folks who instantly identify with it, you know, and also folks who identify sort of repulsed by it. So, you know, as we become more polarized, it's become this sort of weaponized symbol of, well, how do you feel about this? And immediately you can sort of sort into your respective camps.
Do you think that the AR-15 as a symbol for people on the right might change after this assassination attempt with an AR-15?
No, I don't think so, because I don't think that they assigned the weapon the responsibility in this. This is a bad guy who did this shooting. This wasn't the weapon itself. And so I don't expect that they'll change their tune on how they feel about the gun, and it won't lose any of its luster. I mean, if anything, the power of the need for everyone to be armed will be even more apparent now, right? Because there'll be some discussion about, like, well, what if someone else, rather than waiting for law enforcement to respond with their guns, what if they could have responded with their gun earlier and quicker, since, you know, they saw this gunman before law enforcement did?
What have Biden and Trump said about AR-15s and assault weapons in general?
Biden has been a longtime opponent of assault weapons, AR-15. He would love to see a nationwide assault weapons ban. He said this many times publicly. He hasn't been shy about it. Even as, you know, some Democrats have preferred not to talk about it, he has been pretty consistent in saying, I want an assault weapons ban. It's the right thing to do. Trump, you know, as we reported in our piece last year, was initially uncomfortable with it. I think one of his advisors sort of said that was sort of the New York liberal in him, that he was like, why do people need this weapon? But his advisors in the NRA, you know, they quickly explained to him that this is what his supporters, you know, want, that this weapon is part and parcel with that. And he has sort of changed his tune and publicly, you know, now supports the weapon, or, you know, does not support any sort of change to a law to make it harder to get.
The leaders of the Republican National Convention have asked for more security at the convention. And at the same time, Republicans have opposed the assault weapons ban, and the weapon that was used in the assassination attempt is an assault weapon. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
I mean, it's one of those great ironies that both sides see differently. On the right, you know, they talk about these gun-free zones as being the most dangerous places in the country, right? You know, if schools would just arm everybody, they'd be safer. But then, you know, ironically, right, at their convention, those are gun-free zones, just because it's impossible to manage with guns everywhere.
What do you think might be next in terms of an assault weapons ban?
I don't think most people expect that there's any real chance at it, mostly because of the current composition of the Supreme Court, which has this sort of 6-3 conservative liberal split, and has shown a willingness to, if anything, undo current gun laws, to roll them back. And so the idea that they would show an openness to, even if somehow Congress, which hasn't allowed the last assault weapons ban to expire in 2004, if they were somehow to develop the political will to pass one now, it would get struck down by the court. So I think most folks expect that, you know, if there's going to be any sort of additional regulation of assault weapons, it's going to have to be at the state level. And even then, it's sort of dicey because it could be a challenge at the Supreme Court. And so it's going to have to be real, you know, picking little pieces of this weapon, you know, maybe some sort of feature, but the entire weapon itself, there's really no expectation that there's going to be a ban.
Todd Frankel, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Todd Frankel was the lead reporter on the main story of a Washington Post series on the history of the AR-15. The series won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting this year, and the Post has just reposted that AR-15 series. After we take a short break, we'll take a deeper dive into the history of the AR-15 and its current place in gun culture, and listen back to the interview we recorded last year when the series was published. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the assault weapon that was used in the attempted assassination of former President Trump. Now let's listen back to my interview recorded last year with Todd Frankel, the lead reporter on a Washington Post series on the history of the AR-15 and its current place in gun culture. The series won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting this year. It's been reposted on the Washington Post website. Let's start with, if you could list some of the mass shootings that the AR-15 was used as the weapon.
Yeah, I mean, any mass shooting that has made the news that we've all sort of horrified by, the Uvalde shooting down in Texas last year that involved an AR-15 style weapon. Newtown, most famously, back in 2012, was an AR-15. Parkland, Florida, San Bernardino, the shooting in the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, the Las Vegas mass shooting, the worst mass shooting in U.S. history, involved AR-15s. When the death toll gets really high, 10 or more, these horrific things that just you can't look away from and horrify people, usually they involve AR-15s.
Why do mass shooters often choose an AR-15?
Yeah, it's something that some of the mass shooters even explicitly spell out, like in their manifestos they leave behind, like the shooter in the Buffalo mass shooting. I mean, he specifically said, "I chose the AR-15 because it's very good at killing people." It's a military weapon that was sort of modified and changed for the civilian market, and it has taken on this aura that is appealing to folks for many reasons, but also for folks who really want to do a lot of harm.
It's easier to keep steady, to keep steady aim with minimum recoil. Why is that an important feature of the gun?
Yeah, that was one of the innovations and one of the things that made it so appealing to the military at first was it has this gas impingement system, which technically basically means that it redirects some of the energy from a fire bullet to reload the next bullet. And so if there's less recoil, less kick on it, it's easier to keep aim, right? So instead of the front of the rifle kicking upwards with each bullet, it's easier to keep it on a constant target. So it's more accurate. It doesn't hurt. It's much easier to shoot. One of the things for folks who want to go out and fire 40, 50 rounds at a range, to do that with their big old hunting rifle, they'll bruise their shoulder after four or five rounds. The AR-15 is sort of famously easy to shoot and doesn't have much kick.
It's got a lot of speed. I learned this from the Washington Post. The speed of the bullet would cross 6 football fields in 1 second. I can't even fathom that a bullet can go that quickly. So how does the speed of the bullet affect the lethality of the bullet once it enters the body?
Yeah, the AR-15 actually shoots a fairly small bullet. It's known as a 223 or a 5.56, these technical details. But it's a fairly small bullet, but it has a lot of gunpowder behind it. And so it goes incredibly fast. And with that speed and how small the bullet is, when it hits a body, it sort of, once it goes in there, it doesn't just go right out the other side. You referenced some of the work we did, and we had this animation where it showed the difference between getting shot by a typical handgun round, like a 9mm round, versus an AR-15 typical round. A handgun round will go clear through you, that sort of pinhole on both sides. But when an AR-15 round typically hits you, it goes, that makes that small entry wound, but then inside it creates this shock wave, this blasting pattern that blows out the backside of people, causes internal injuries, and it's just devastating. It makes it very effective for a military weapon, but it's horrific when you see these in civilians.
So the AR-15 is a semi-automatic version of the combat rifle, the M16, which was an automatic weapon. The M16 was standard-issue rifle in Vietnam. A Pentagon report described the M16 as an outstanding weapon with phenomenal lethality. So what's the difference between the M16, which was first used in combat in Vietnam, and the AR-15, which is being marketed to civilians?
They're very similar. The biggest difference is that the M16, the military's rifle, is capable of automatic fire, which means if you pull and hold down the trigger, it'll keep firing bullets, whereas the AR-15, the one anyone can pretty much buy in a store, is one trigger pull, one bullet. But, you know, it goes as quick as you can pull it. But that's still the main difference. But the gun itself is functionally otherwise the same as what is being used by the military.
So how did a weapon that was designed for combat become slightly redesigned for civilians? Like, was it somebody's idea? Can you pinpoint the person who decided, let's take this combat weapon and find a way to mass market it to civilians?
You know, the gun industry itself had huge doubts about this gun. They didn't welcome it at its trade shows. We spoke to AR-15 manufacturers who talk about the hostility that they faced from other gun manufacturers. You know, like, what are you doing with this weapon that they thought was for maybe for law enforcement, maybe for the military? But, like, you know, they didn't see it as having a role in the civilian gun market, which was pretty much like handguns and hunting rifles, traditional hunting rifles. If you think about, you know, a grandfather's hunting rifle or the one you might see hanging in the back of a pickup truck. But when the assault weapons ban, the U.S. federal assault weapons ban expired in 2004, no major gun manufacturer actually made an AR-15. And it was a couple years later that Smith & Wesson, which I think was sort of a pivotal moment when they decided, you know what, for the first time in our long history, going back to the 1850s, we're going to make not only a rifle, we're going to make the AR-15.
Was that controversial within the gun industry?
It was. Again, there was this hostility towards the weapon itself, this sort of military gun, you know, what do ordinary gun owners need with this? But the gun industry itself was suffering several years of flat sales, right? Guns, there's no planned obsolescence with a gun. They last for decades. You know, you can hand them down for generations. And so at some point, you know, you've sold pretty much every hunting rifle and handgun that folks can buy, and they're looking for something new. And Smith & Wesson did this market study looking for new markets to tap into, and they found that there was some interest in this, what they call the tactical rifle market, which was the AR-15.
So, you know, the series mentions a man named Harry Falber, who ended up being the head of licensing at Smith & Wesson. And he came from the ad world. He had been an ad man in big companies. And when he came to Smith & Wesson, he wanted to test out what kind of advertising seemed to work best for Smith & Wesson. So he took out two ads in Guns and Ammo, one a kind of more traditional gun ad and one a gun ad for the AR-15, and basically tried to figure out which consumers responded better to. Can you describe those ads?
Yeah, I mean, Harry was a traditional, he describes himself as like from the Mad Men era of advertising. He'd worked for many, you know, Hallmark, Volvo. He'd worked on these very mainstream brand campaigns. And so when he got to Smith & Wesson, they were trying to figure out how to market this AR-15 and also to sell their guns in general. And so he did this study where they placed two ads in Guns & Ammo magazine. And they were very different in tone, and it sort of illustrates the change in marketing that would come with the AR-15 throughout the industry. And one shows two pistols side by side, and the big headline, the tagline is fine-tuned machines. The other ad showed a police SWAT team officer. I mean, he's wearing dark gloves and a tactical helmet. I mean, he's pointing the AR-15 at some unseen target just out of the frame there. And underneath, the big words say, the chosen one.
So two things in that version of the ad. The chosen one is a kind of like making the gun into like this heroic figure. And also by advertising, like, you could be like this SWAT team officer who's seeing the action. You could have the same kind of thing just as a civilian, not having to join the police even.
Yeah, no, and that was that sort of darker edge of marketing that at the time was still sort of unwelcomed or sort of challenged in the industry. But now that's pretty much just how guns are advertised. It's this sort of darker, sort of more aggressive. There's a threat out there and you need to confront it. You know, just like the police do, you can be just like them. And that's mainstream firearms marketing today. And to Harry, the testing, you know, with consumers about how they reacted, they actually found that the fine-tuned machines, the more tame approach, was more popular with consumers. But there was something about this other one that really appealed to Smith & Wesson executives, Harry was telling us. And So they actually went in that direction. It was not just choosing the chosen one for that one particular ad, but it was this tenor of advertising and marketing the gun that was different than how they had marketed guns previously. And it's dark. It's sort of threatening. There's this idea that, you know, the appeal is that tactical SWAT teams use it and the military uses it, not that you can go out hunting turkeys on the weekend with it.
And one of the reasons I think why he spoke out is in 2012, after he decided to leave Smith & Wesson because he didn't like the idea of these assault weapons, just a couple of months later was the Sandy Hook massacre in the elementary school, and he lived just like 20 miles away from Sandy Hook.
Yeah, he was horrified by that, and his wife worked in education, and I think he was just horrified by the idea that he had played any role in popularizing that gun.
We're listening back to the interview I recorded last year with Todd Frankel, the lead reporter on the main story of a Washington Post series on the history of the AR-15. That's the weapon that was used by the shooter who attempted to assassinate Donald Trump. The series won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting this year. The Post has reposted the series on its website. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. And from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback Wilderness. With standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and all-terrain tires, it's designed for paths not yet taken. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about the assault weapon that was used in the assassination attempt against former President Trump, the AR-15. It's become the weapon of choice for mass shooters. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with Todd Frankel, the lead reporter on the main story of a Washington Post series on the history of the AR-15. The series won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting this year. Our interview was recorded when the series was first published. The Post has reposted the story on its website. I was surprised to read that after mass shootings, the sales of the AR-15 go up.
Yeah, and that's because it's the center of the gun conversation, the gun control conversation, where folks say, well, what are we going to do about how are we going to address these mass shootings? And someone will say, well, we should have banned these assault weapons. And so that drives everyone scared on the other side who says runs out and
let's buy an assault weapon before it's too late, before it's banned.
Right. Yeah, it's going to be taken. You know, they're coming for your assault weapons, AR-15, and come and take it. You know, that sort of attitude is on there, too. And so, yeah, sales react to that, and folks are just stripped gun shops clean of these guns.
You know, we talked a little bit about the ad campaigns for the AR-15. There was also some pretty clever marketing behind them, and one of the facets of that is working with video game manufacturers. What was that relationship like? How did gun manufacturers get their guns into video games as a way of making people want those guns?
Yeah, I mean, there's a very popular video game franchise called Call of Duty, which is sort of a shooting game, right? And so gun manufacturers, you know, would work with these video game manufacturers to make sure that their guns were included or referenced. And, you know, we even described this one moment in the late 2000s where a video game manufacturer and a gun manufacturer go out to this desert in outside of Las Vegas to capture the sound rifle, AR-15 style rifle being fired, because they want to make sure it's accurate and realistic. And we've talked to gun owners who designed their AR-15s based on what they had used in the Call of Duty games earlier, as when they were too young to own a weapon. You know, they would then trick out their gun to sort of match what they had used in these video games.
Despite the success of sales with the AR-15, there were still people within the gun industry, within the gun world, who objected to it. But there was a lot of pressure to keep those people quiet or to kind of push them out. And one example that is written about in the Washington Post series is Jim Zumbo. Tell us about him and the story of what happened when he objected to the AR-15.
Hey, Jim Zumbo was a well-known personality in the gun world, and you know, he had a TV show, he had a column in gun magazines. He was just a well-known guy, and this was in the early 2000s or late 2000s, you know, around 2006, 2007, when the gun is just sort of taking off and the gun industry is still getting sort of comfortable with this weapon itself. And he sort of came out and said, I don't think this is a good gun for hunting. It's still sort of a controversial point, you know, whether the AR-15, you know, folks who love the weapon will say, oh, yes, you need it. It's perfect for hunting boars. But it's, you know, a lot of folks think that the bullet is so powerful that the same thing it does to human bodies, it does to an animal. It blows it apart. That's not great in general for hunting, especially if you're going to eat the meat. And so he came out with this, you know, very early on and said, you know, I just don't think, because I think he called it a terrorist rifle. And the blowback was immediate. He lost his positions throughout the industry, his TV show, his column. He was sort of cast aside. And it actually became a sort of watchword within the industry that, you know, if you speak out against this gun, you're going to get zumboed. That's what we found, that finding folks who were willing to speak out about what they saw in the gun industry was really difficult. It's, you know, it's you're either with us or against us. And that made reporting very difficult. And we found a few people willing to talk with us and describe what they saw. But, you know, there was a lot of fear about being zumboed.
Have you been to a lot of gun shows over the years?
I have, yeah.
And how have the displays for AR-15s changed in that period?
It's remarkable. And it's sort of been gradual. But then only when you look at it, you know, over several years, that you sort of realize, oh, it wasn't always this way. And I think even folks who are around guns a lot, it's sort of that frog in the pot with the temperature slowly getting hotter. You know, you walk into a gun show or a gun store today, and it's like black rifles, AR-15s, as they call them, black rifles, all along the wall, and handguns in the display case. And that's pretty much it. I mean, again, we have this sort of, I think, still this popular notion of, you know, the hunting rifle, the wood-stocked hunting rifle, that you load it and then you fire it and then you load it again. But what is being sold at gun shows, at gun stores today, is a military tactical rifle, black rifle, that can fire, you know, 30 rounds without being reloaded, if not more. But for it to have such market dominance, you know, one in four guns manufactured these days, it's unmistakable. It's changed everything about the gun industry.
What about gun culture?
And gun culture, yeah. I mean, they're sort of intertwined. The gun industry is not a huge industry, but so they are very closely tied to the culture itself. And, you know, they are making directly what folks want, and that is then reflected back in driving sales. So they sort of go hand in hand. I mean, you know, there's a group called Gun Owners of America, and their mascot or their logo is a Minuteman from the Revolutionary Times holding a musket. And, you know, there was some discussion, you know, I was talking to folks about this, there was some discussion within the group about changing that Minuteman from holding a musket to holding an AR-15, right? So they're putting the AR-15 on that sort of pedestal as the iconic American weapon. And that's where I think things have really changed.
We're listening back to the interview I recorded last year with Todd Frankel, the lead reporter on the main story of a Washington Post series on the history of the AR-15, the weapon that was used in the assassination attempt against Donald Trump. The series won a Pulitzer Prize this year for national reporting. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR.
This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the AR-15, the weapon that was used in the attempted assassination of former President Trump. Let's get back to the interview I recorded last year with Todd Frankel, the lead reporter on the main story of a Washington Post series on the history of the AR-15. The series won a Pulitzer Prize this year for national reporting. So the Sandy Hook massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, the massacre in the elementary school back in 2012. How did that focus attention on the AR-15, which was the weapon that was used in that assault? 154 rounds were fired, 20 children were killed, 6 school employees were killed.
Yeah, that was a pivotal moment, right? You know, I think for a lot of Americans, it's probably the first time they've really been introduced to this weapon. The wounds in there were devastating. Kids, you know, just frankly torn apart by what happened in those classrooms. And folks were horrified. There was this President Obama, you know, I think folks remember some of the speeches he gave immediately after. And then there was that tense standoff with the NRA about, you know, what are we going to do? And that's when they came up, Wayne LaPierre came up with that line of, you know, the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And there was that whole discussion about arming folks in schools. And there was that push to then, right, resurrect the assault weapons ban. And what are we going to do? And that was the talk. And that failed. You know, even some Democrats have voted against that. And from there, that drove sales too, right? So that happened. The Sandy Hook shooting happened in December of 2012. And an all-time record for FBI background gun sale checks was in that month as folks like ran into gun stores and bought anything they had, but especially bought their AR-15s, believing that a ban was just around the corner. And when the political will behind that sort of faded and failed, I think it emboldened the gun industry then to say, all right, this gun's here to stay. And it became this increasingly a sort of culture icon, right? Sort of figured where you stood on things is, do you support folks owning this sort of weapon?
There were some large stores, including some chains, that stopped carrying AR-15s, stopped selling them after Sandy Hook. And the sales increased. There's still a lot of disillusionment about the weapon. How did the NRA and the gun industry push back against that?
You know, Dick's Sporting Goods sort of famously decided to stop selling the AR-15, although they would backtrack because they would sell it at a subsidiary store called Field & Stream for a little while. And then after the Parkland school shooting, they decided to get rid of AR-15s entirely. But the NRA went to some of these stores, like Cabela's, you know, so these big outfitters, and said, you know, had to reassure them that, like, yes, you might face pressure, but listen, you have to understand your customer. And that's where it becomes this cultural flashpoint, you know, where your customers, meaning gun owners, you know, want you to keep selling this and you don't want to give in to the other side. So, you know, you're going to have to just weather this. And a lot of them held on and sort of kept selling it. I mean, I find it interesting that Walmart doesn't sell the AR-15 anymore. They stopped in 2015. The biggest retailer in the U.S. doesn't sell this sort of iconic American weapon. They stopped, they claim, because of demand. They just, you know, just wasn't there. But, you know, retailers, they don't want to be selling the weapon that's used in school shootings. But they also don't want to upset the side that believes that the AR-15 is just as good as any other gun, is important to our constitutional rights.
How did gun rights become a top issue for Republicans, with often a focus on AR-15s?
Especially after the Newtown shooting, and you had this sort of standoff between President Obama and the NRA. It was, again, that sort of, are you with us or against us sort of focus. And it became a political symbol, right? The NRA and Republicans saw that this was something that a lot of Democrats hated. They hated this gun. They hated the look of it. They hated what it had done. And they could campaign and fundraise and drive it was a cultural wedge issue. It was very a potent one too, right? I mean, it was pretty dependable, a pretty good predictor of how folks, what political affiliation they had, was how they viewed the AR-15, because it had been just filled up with so much cultural significance that you could reliably tell how someone would vote based on their attitude towards this one gun.
So the Washington Post series describes the AR-15 as having become a political symbol in campaigns. How has it been used that way?
Yeah, it's just think about those. We see this pop up in the news, those holiday cards from almost, well, certainly only Republican officials of holding their whole family holding AR-15, you know, even the teenage kids, maybe even younger, holding AR-15s. To the TV ad, political ads, where folks are firing AR-15s. You know, they might used to, maybe a generation ago, fire a hunting rifle to show that they understood that sort of thing. But now it is an AR-15 that carries much more political weight. We had the handful of Republican congressmen and women who wore little AR-15 pins, right, silver pins on their lapels on Capitol Hill. To sort of show their allegiance, their support for gun rights. The AR-15 is very much this sort of signifier of your politics, and it has such a distinct outline of the gun, you know, the sort of clip coming down, the ammunition clip coming down, and the long nose and the buttstock on it, that it's instantly recognizable. And so you put on a bumper sticker, you put it on a T-shirt, and you put a slogan with it, like, come and take it. And it's a great political signifier.
I want you to tell the story of C.J. Grisham and his use of the AR-15 in a political and an identity way.
C.J. Grisham was down, out for a walk with his son in rural Texas, and this is in 2013, and he has an AR-15 with him, and he's just walking down the side of this, like, dirt road, gravel road. And when he's stopped by the police officer, and the police officer, you know, says, why do you have this? And Grisham's answer is, because I can. And there's a slight scuffle. It's not a big deal. But he ends up getting convicted of misdemeanor police interference. It seems like it's one of those things that could have gone away, except there was dash cam video of it. And
So Grisham's the one who gets convicted.
Yeah. And so he is just sort of outraged by the way he was treated. I mean, he's not doing anything. He's just carrying this gun. We have to imagine this is a decade ago, before open carry and these sort of wearing it to public protests is almost a common thing. So when he did it, it was sort of still like, whoa, you know, what's going on? But he founds this group in Texas called Open Carry Texas, advocating for carrying weapons in public. And it sort of just takes off, this idea that, you know, and folks would, when they would, they'd start doing these like pop-up demonstrations in Texas especially, and they would carry their hunting rifles, their shotguns, but also their AR-15s, and just go into stores. They would go into Chipotle's and Home Depot's and just open carry. And it was one of those things that was sort of interesting, because this is, again, a decade ago. The Newtown mass shooting had only happened a year before, and the NRA actually criticized this. They thought it was a little weird. Actually, they called it downright weird that he was doing this. But then their membership got so upset with them that they backed off and said, all right, no, we understand what he's doing. And now that idea, that movement of open carry, that you should be able to carry your AR-15 strapped across your chest or somehow not hide it when you're out in public, it's pretty commonplace. I mean, again, we've seen these, especially during the COVID lockdown protests at state capitals and stuff, you know, folks who were carrying these big military looking assault rifles on their chests, and it sends a message. And it sort of changed the tenor of different debates, I think.
the Second Amendment, as interpreted by gun activists and the gun manufacturers, the gun lobby, the Second Amendment is seen as upholding your right to carry any kind of gun. But no matter how you interpret the Second Amendment, it doesn't literally say anything about ammunition, about the bullets. So there's been proposals to limit high-capacity magazines, because that would limit the number of rounds somebody could fire off without having to reload. And if they had to reload, might give an opportunity for somebody to tackle the mass shooter.
You know, it's a fascinating topic, because the idea of limiting the number of bullets someone can hold in a single magazine, it sounds sort of maybe what's the point? But there's a lot of research that shows that that's perhaps a very American solution to this issue. Like, if we're not going to get rid of the guns, at least give the folks who are caught in these horrible moments a shot at survival. This happened in Newtown, where the gunman had to reload. And when he reloaded, and even though you could be very quick with reloading, even those few precious seconds, they call it a critical pause. Some kids escaped. They ran out of the classroom. And the idea that if you interject and require some sort of forced pause in the shooting, that it'll at least limit the carnage. It won't avoid it all, because we're going to still have these guns. But at least with a ban on the size of the magazine, they at least give folks a shot at survival.
Well, Todd Frankel, thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you for your reporting for the series in The Washington Post.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Todd Frankel was the lead reporter on the main story of a Washington Post series on the history of the AR-15. The series won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting this year. The Post has reposted the series on its website. Our interview was recorded last year when the series was first published. After we take a short break, Ken Tucker continues his series on great albums that were recorded 50 years ago and revisits a Stevie Wonder album. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. As part of his summer series about great albums turning 50 years old, rock critic Ken Tucker has chosen Stevie Wonder's 1974 album, fulfilling this first finale. Although it went to number one, Ken says he thinks the album is underrated for reasons he'll explain. Here's Stevie Wonder and the song that opens the album, Smile Please.
In the first half of the 1970s, any list of the most popular music acts would have included Elton John, John Denver, the Rolling Stones. But there was no hitmaker working at as high a level of creativity as Stevie Wonder. He released back-to-back masterpiece albums in 72 and 73, Talking Book and Inner Visions, respectively. He followed those up with a mouthful of alliteration for an album title, Fulfillingness's First Finale. It continued his hot streak. In the summer of 1974, it was impossible to avoid the jittery rhythms and bouncy vocals of one of the album's hit singles, Boogie On, Reggae Woman.
Hi.
despite the fact that it was neither reggae nor a boogie, Boogie on Reggae Woman was played everywhere because it was catchy and because people could not get enough of the sound of Stevie Wonder's voice, a reedy croon with a smile tucked inside it. By this time, Wonder had become, along with Marvin Gaye, one of the few Motown artists in complete control of his recordings, writing, producing, and hiring the musicians he wanted to execute his compositions.
They say that heaven is 10 zillion light years away, and just the pure at heart will walk a righteous street someday. They say
that's Heaven is 10 Zillion Light Years Away, a song that begins with Wonder asking if there's a God, only to blossom into a chorus about God's love filling his spirit. As ethereal as the music is, Wonder was also rooted in reality. At another point in the song, he sings the question, "Why must my color black make me a lesser man?" And later in the album, Wonder will offer the best protest song he ever wrote. "You Haven't Done Nothing" is the angry cry of a citizen dismayed by the hollow promises of politicians, a citizen who also happens to be a genius musician.
We are amazed but not amused by all the things you say that you do. Though much concerned but not involved with decisions that are made by you. But we are sick and tired.
"You Haven't Done Nothing" was a pointed criticism of the Richard Nixon administration. It was released as a single on August 7th. Nixon resigned a day later. But it transcends its context to exist now as a vivid showcase for Wonder's music making at this point, playing keyboards as the lead instrument, drums that establish the rhythm grooves, harmonica when he feels like it. Fulfilling This Is First finale won the Grammy for Best Album of the Year, yet today it feels underrated. I think that's partly because its overall tone was more subdued, more meditative than the albums immediately preceding it. A gorgeous ballad like this one, called Creepin', sounds utterly contemporary today. Following this album, Wonder would release a double album masterpiece, Songs in the Key of Life, in 1976. By any measure, it was a remarkable run for any musician ever. And his gifts just keep on giving. Fulfilling This Is First finale remains ripe for rediscovery in 2024.
Rock critic Ken Tucker revisited Stevie Wonder's 1974 album, Fulfilling This First finale. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, our guest will be Julianne Nicholson. Proud to call herself a character actor, she's appeared in dozens of films and TV series, from Ally McBeal and Boardwalk Empire to August Osage County and Mayor of Easttown, where she earned an Emmy Award. She stars in the new film Janet Planet. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Thea Challoner, Susan Yacundi, and Joel Wolfram. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our co-host is Tanya Mosley. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive. With small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. And from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.